This morning, as Jim did not continue in my series in Daniel, he did his own thing. I wasn't going to shoulder him with this, so I'm going to cover two chapters, chapter 4 and 5. If you remember, 2 weeks ago, we covered chapter 3 and 6 because those kind of tied in together, and 4 and 5 kind of tie in together. Then we'll jump to chapter 7 next week, and that begins a lot of Daniel's visions and dreams that he has. And we'll talk about what all that means for us. But this morning we're going to look at Daniel 4 and 5. And while we had been kind of following around Daniel and his buddies and how they were living in the empire, and as we could relate to them, as I said, we're living in an empire as well, and how we're supposed to live and walk around, and how followers of Jesus might continue to be faithful to following Jesus in the midst of an empire. Daniel and his buddies were trying to do that same thing. So we're going to kind of switch gears here, and we're actually going to look at two leaders of this empire, two kings of Babylon. One is Nebuchadnezzar. We were introduced to him before. You might remember he's the guy that likes to cut people to pieces and put people's homes into rubble. That's like his thing that he does. So we'll see him again, and then we'll see Belshazzar, who is another Babylonian king. And we're going to learn something about them and how that relates to human empires, human kingdoms that put themselves in the place of God. But that's actually going to come home to us as well as individuals. What happens when we as individuals put ourselves in the place of God? And what does that look like? How does that actually happen? So to begin that and to begin this story, I want to remind us of something that I've been reminding us of. And that says Daniel 3 and 6. That is wrong. It's Daniel 4 and 5, not 3 and 6. But there's something that I've been saying each and every Sunday. Now, I didn't say it last Sunday because I wasn't here. That the entire book of Daniel is trying to remind us of something. As Daniel is writing this to a diaspora of Jews, that is, Jews scattered all over the earth. They're not in Jerusalem. They don't have a hometown anymore. They don't have a land of their own. They're not in the promised land. They don't have the temple anymore. That's been smashed to pieces. So they're scattered. And they're wondering, has God forgotten about us? All the promises we heard about God, are they still true? Can we have confidence? Can we have hope in this God who says he's made this covenant with us? And so Daniel writes this to remind them of something. Do any of you remember what he reminded them of? Oh, you wrote it down. You were taking notes. Good for you. This still is a BYOB church. Bring your own Bible to church. I'm not going to put the scripture up here. So I'm not also providing any paper. Some of you used to use your bulletins to write notes on, so you got to do that yourself. Jess, number one student. There's no prejudice here. What is the reminder? If you didn't hear that, this is what she said. She wrote it down verbatim. Good job, Jess, number one student. I love you. In spite of what we see all around us, when it seems like evil is winning the day, Daniel is trying to remind us with all of these stories that he's telling us, with the visions we're going to hear about in chapter 7 through 12, he is trying to remind his readers and all of us that God will reign supreme and God will have the final victory. Death has lost its grip on us. Jesus has defeated it. And while Daniel is looking forward to that day, we are living in that day and with that promise in which Jesus has conquered the grave. That's why we're here. That's what Paul says. We might as well not gather if it didn't happen. If the resurrection didn't take place, there's no point in us sitting in this place and talking about it. But it did. And because of the reality of the resurrection, we can live with hope, with confidence, and courageously, because God, though it might not look like it right now, God will reign supreme. And so that is the overarching theme of the book of Daniel. And as we hear some stories in Daniel 4 and 5 specifically dealing with two kings, we don't want to lose sight of this truth, because God is going to bring this truth home to these two kings in these stories. And we'll hear how he does that. But to begin, it's going to remind us again, we got a couple more rounds here of this clash of kings and cultures, kings and kingdoms. And Nebuchadnezzar has already gone toe-to-toe with God a couple of times. We read about those, we heard those stories, and we know that Nebuchadnezzar lost each of those rounds. And you have to go back to the previous messages to hear those. But we've got a new contender now, Belshazzar, another king, and he's going to go toe-to-toe with the God of Israel. And I'll leave up to you who you think wins this round also. But these two stories, why we're putting them together is because they're very similar. They're kind of two different people, but telling the same story. And it has to do with an issue that kings and emperors don't just deal with, but all of us actually deal with. And if we're not careful, it can really infect society and it can turn us in a direction that we really don't want to go, in a road that we don't want to go down, in our own individual lives and in our lives as a society as well. So it has to do with pride. This idea of, in the story of Daniel, putting ourselves in the place of God. So I want us to think about how pride looks as little kids, and then think about what that looks like as we get older. As little kids, it's probably not as big of a deal, but we begin to see it in small children when they say, I can do it myself. So when kids begin to learn how to talk and how to walk around and start doing things, you probably hear them say, I can do it myself. I can do it myself. And so I can remember our kids saying that same thing on monkey bars. We have a playset at the house, and they get on the monkey bars, and they get on one, and they're like, I can do it myself. And they get on another one, and now they're hanging there. And they can't move, and I'm sitting there watching them, and I just, you know, wait a little bit until they're like, realize I'm in trouble, you know, until a small child, drop in front, it's not really high. For us small people, it's high. But for a small child, it's like, I'm on a cliff and I'm going to fall. But they can do it themselves. And so, of course, we go over and I hold on to them and then they go across and then I let them, you know, get down. Now, that, you know, that's just part of growing. That's growing up. That's kids. And it's if we let it go, it's called pride. You can't do it all yourself. You need help. Pride gets in the way of you receiving help. And pride gets in the way, and when you don't need help, and you know what? Some of us can do a lot on our own. And then we start to think we don't need anybody. And then maybe we start to think we don't even need God either. And so now we're at that stage of helping our children learn how to do things themselves and not doing it for them. But now I'm like, but they're growing up so fast, and sooner or later, they're not going to need my help anymore at all. And so we still kind of like doing things for them. So I still got to get the, we're trying to, you know, have Leah do her toothbrush and toothpaste. So if I don't do it, the toothpaste, it goes all over the place. It's all over the sink. It's all over the toothbrush. It's all over the, and I'm telling her, you need to learn how to brush your teeth by yourself. But I still kind of want to help her. Because before long, I'm not going to need to help her anymore. And if you've raised children, you know what that's like. But if we don't help our kids understand that all through life you need help, if we as adults don't realize, hey, I'm doing pretty good at my job, I'm making a lot of money, I'm doing well, I've got the things that I want, I'm not really sure I need God that much. And that starts creeping in. And when that starts creeping in, we're headed to a fall. Now, we can see how that might play out as individuals, and if that plays out on a whole society, we're in trouble. I remember, just to give one more example of what's going to happen here in Daniel 4 and 5, one more present-day example, I remember when we had Adult and Teen Challenge here, and Sean Ryan, who is now doing a lot of the director of Adult and Teen Challenge, when the guys go out, share their testimonies, we had them sing. They came last year for our church picnic when we were outside. And I remember Sean saying that as a, you know, he was addicted to drugs and alcohol and went to Teen Challenge, got clean, and he was getting put in charge of a lot of stuff, and a lot of stuff was going really well. And he said, I remember him saying this outside here, he said he kind of, if you've ever been over in Rarersburg, where they are, they call it God's Mountain, and it kind of looks out over the campus of Teen Challenge, and there's a lot of cornfields, and it's a beautiful setting. And he said he remembers looking out over the campus and saying, wow, Sean, look what you were able to do. And he tells the story about how he fell harder than he'd ever fallen before when he said that. And he had to start all over again. And he confessed in front of all of us. I was impressed with his vulnerability in sharing that story. He confessed in front of all of us that it was pride that had gotten in the way and affected him, it affected his whole family, it affected Teen Challenge and the guys who were there and the people that he had influence over, the people's lives he was trying to help to turn around. Pride can destroy people's lives and it can destroy an entire empire, as we'll see in these stories. So that's the issue that Daniel is dealing with, but it's on a grand scale as he's talking about Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. So I'm not going to read the entire story for you of chapter 4 and chapter 5. I just want to read bits and pieces of it for you and then kind of explain what's going on there, and then we'll tie that into how that affects us today as 21st century Christians. So we know Nebuchadnezzar is the emperor, the king of the day. And he's already had a dream that nobody could interpret except Daniel. And that was back in the earlier chapters. This dream of this statue made of all kinds of different metals, and it disturbed him. And that was when he was a younger man. He had just become emperor. He had just ransacked Jerusalem and taken Jews into exile. And Daniel and his buddies just landed in Babylon and were getting trained. And now Nebuchadnezzar is older in his reign. And it seems that his dream is coming true. He was, at this statue in the previous dream, a head of gold. The statue had a head of gold. And Daniel said, that's you. And so that's where Nebuchadnezzar is now. In verse 4 it says, I, Nebuchadnezzar of chapter 4 in Daniel, was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. It's almost as though he was standing outside on that balcony looking over his vast kingdom. And really, all people on earth were his subject. He was contented and he was prosperous. He was at the pinnacle of his reign. In verse 5, though, it says, I had a dream that made me afraid. Same thing that happened earlier. He had a dream that made him afraid. And I was lying in bed, and the images and visions that passed through my mind terrified me. So I commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be brought before me to interpret the dream for me. So same scenario has happened before. Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. It terrifies him, probably wakes him up in his sleep. And so he calls in the magicians, the astrologers, the diviners, all the people that went to school for a really long time to be able to interpret these dreams. He calls them all in again. None of them can do it. So they got to go back to good old Daniel, and Daniel comes in to interpret the dream that he has. Now, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had to do with his greatness. The dream, God was using this dream to reveal Nebuchadnezzar's greatness to him and what he was about to do. And so Nebuchadnezzar's dream is about this giant tree. And this dream is very similar to lots of ancient Near Eastern stories about a tree that gives life. It wasn't just this dream that talked about a tree that gave life. There were lots of stories from lots of different cultures that talked about this cosmic tree that went from the earth into the sky into heaven. And this tree gave life. And so Nebuchadnezzar has a dream like this, where he sees this tree, and it's huge, it's big, and its branches expand really far, and it's full of leaves and fruit, and birds come, and they nest in it, they make their home in it. Animals come, and they have shade in it from the heat, and they live under this tree, and there's plentiful and abundance of fruit where people are living off of it. It's like this tree that gives life. And so he's dreaming about this, and then this messenger, this being from heaven, some supernatural being, comes and chops down this tree. They cut the tree down. The tree falls over. The leaves wither. There's no more food. The birds scatter. The animals flee. And all that's left is this trunk, the roots and the trunk of this tree. And the angel, the messenger that cut this tree down, says this in verse 17 of chapter 4. The decision is announced by messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict so that the living may know. This is why you're having this dream, Nebuchadnezzar. So that the living may know that the Most High, basically God, Yahweh, is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of people. So that dream terrifies Nebuchadnezzar. It's probably not hard for him to do a little bit of his own interpretation in that he is the one who is providing all this for the world. I, as the king, emperor over all the earth, provide life. And whatever I say goes. But he's not sure, probably, about why this tree gets cut down. And so the angel reveals this. Nobody can interpret it, so Daniel gets called into the scene. And he tells Nebuchadnezzar probably what he already kind of knew in verse 20. The tree you saw, which grew large and strong with its tops touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves and abundant fruit, providing food for all, giving shelter to the wild animals, and having nesting places in the branches for the birds. Your Majesty, you are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to the distant parts of the earth. And then he goes on to say why the tree is getting cut down. Your Majesty saw a holy one, a messenger coming down from heaven and saying, cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump bound with iron and bronze in the grass of the field, while its roots remain in the ground. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live with the wild animals until seven times pass by for him. This is the interpretation of what you saw in your dream, Daniel says. Your Majesty, this is the interpretation, Your Majesty, and this is the decree the Most High has issued, that Yahweh, God of Israel, my God, has issued to you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals and will eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass by before you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored when you acknowledge that heaven rules. And so Daniel goes on to plead with him to renounce his sin, stop being wicked and oppressing those who are disadvantaged, those who are the least in your kingdom, and turn and acknowledge God. That's what the dream is all about. You dreamt about your greatness, but in your dream, God showed you that he will humble you. God is the one who allows kings to rise and to fall. Nothing goes beyond his capacity. He is sovereign over all of this. And your dream is letting you know that. So what do you think Nebuchadnezzar did? Oh, okay, well, if God rules over all, I guess I should change my ways, shouldn't I? But there's this little thing called pride that creeps in. And it says in verse 28, all this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. And we hear the story that 12 months later, after this dream, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, this is what he said. Is not this the great Babylon that I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? And as the words were coming out of his mouth, God judges him, and what Daniel said would happen takes place. He basically goes insane. And there is an actual disease that people can get that makes you think you're an animal. I can't remember what it's called, but you can Google it and find out. And he thought he was an ox, and so he goes out and starts eating grass, and he goes crazy. He's insane. Because he would not acknowledge Daniel's God. And his pride got in the way. And so we hear about another king. Nebuchadnezzar is out of the picture. We'll hear what happens to him. And Daniel's giving us two different pictures here. What does Nebuchadnezzar do with his pride? We'll find that out in just a minute. But first we got to talk about Daniel 5 and Belshazzar. And rather than having a dream, a hand appears and just starts writing on the wall over there. That's what he sees. So Nebuchadnezzar is dead. Belshazzar is now king, and this is what it says. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. And while Belshazzar was drinking his wine, it's a giant party with the never-ending barrels of wine. And while he was giving this party, he gave the orders to bring the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, not literally his father, but ancestor, that's the translation, it's more like his ancestor, the king before him, kings before him. He says, bring the gold and silver goblets that he took out of Jerusalem when he defeated them, and we're going to drink wine out of all that stuff. Just start pouring it in, all that kind of stuff. And we're going to drink wine out of that. And what they start doing is they start having these toasts. Let's toast the God of silver and the God of bronze and the God of wood and the God of stone. And they just start basically making a mockery of these goblets. Now, if you remember from weeks previous, in the temple in Jerusalem, there is no statue that Babylon can take and say, see, our gods beat your gods. We're going to take your statue and put it in our temple. They didn't have any statues. Remember, you weren't supposed to make a graven image. So all they had in the temple were the temple vessels or the stuff they used for their acts of worship, their celebrations, their festivals. So instead of taking a statue of some god, they took all their vessels, all their stuff, all the instruments they used, and they put it in their temple. And even the pagan king Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't dare take instruments used for the gods and use it for himself. He didn't even do this. So Belshazzar is even more wicked than that guy, and he's like, oh, who cares? Get all that stuff from that temple and let's start drinking out of that. So that's what they do. They have all these toasts and this party to all these other gods. Suddenly, in verse 5, the fingers of a human hand appeared and began writing on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal place. And the king watched the hand as it wrote. And in verse 6 it says, his face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. So if you were to translate that, the NIV translates it that way to kind of help us make us understand it. Maybe to clean up the language a little bit, I'm not sure. But really, in the Aramaic, he basically messed himself. He was so afraid, he lost control of his bowels. And this scared, you know, the stuff out of him. And he was terrified. And so he does the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar did. Call the guys, get them in here, and have them tell me what that says. And they can't do it. And then somebody remembers, it says that the queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. It wouldn't be his wife, be like the queen mother, be either his mom or one of his brother's moms, because they had lots of different wives in those days. And she comes in and says, there is somebody in this kingdom that can interpret that. His name's Daniel. He did it before, and he can do it again, I'm sure. And they call Daniel in. So Daniel comes in to interpret what's going on. And so Daniel is brought before the king, and Daniel basically gives him a little history lesson in verse 18. The king says to him, if you can interpret this, you'll be number three in command of this empire. Number three. Daniel says, keep your gifts, I don't need them. Verse 18 says, Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness, glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Whatever he said went. If you wanted to put somebody to death, he did it. If you wanted to spare somebody, he spared him. If you wanted to promote somebody, he promoted him. If you wanted to humble somebody, he humbled him. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne, stripped of his glory, and he became like an animal. He became like one of the beasts of the field. Because God was showing him that he needed to acknowledge the God of Israel, Yahweh, the one true God, as the Most High and sovereign over all the kingdoms, and realize that he is the one who allows kings to rise and to fall. So then Daniel interprets for Belshazzar the inscription on the wall. And this is in verse 25. And then depending on what your translation says, it's many, many tekel parson. That's loosely translated. I think that's how you say it. I don't know. We'll go with that for this morning. Here is what these words mean. So he translates for him what it says on the wall. God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. The greatness of your kingdom is coming to an end. The next word that he translates, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. God is going to judge you for your pride. In the last word he translates, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And so we have two stories of two kings and their greatness, and they putting themselves in the place of God and going toe-to-toe with the God of Israel. One king, God, drives into the field, and he becomes like an ox and starts eating grass, and he's crazy. And the other king is basically assassinated that night, and his kingdom comes to an end. Verse 30, it says, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. It's over. We've gone through five chapters of this gigantic kingdom over all of the earth, and like that, it's gone in a moment, in an instant. History tells us, this is extra-biblical literature, that there wasn't even a fight as the Persians rolled into town in Babylon and basically conquered the greatest city on earth. In a moment, that empire that ruled the entire planet is gone and a new one takes its place. We learn about two kings and their pride. One king, their pride led to death as God humbled him. What I didn't read for you in Nebuchadnezzar is that Nebuchadnezzar humbled himself and ultimately was restored. Verse 34 in chapter 4, at the end of that time of being crazy, basically, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Almost as though he can't even speak because he's insane, he casts his eyes into heaven and says, God, you alone are sovereign. As he turns his eyes toward heaven, his sanity returns, and I praise the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. And it basically says his entire kingdom was restored. As Nebuchadnezzar humbles himself, realizes that he is not God, when he was standing on his palace balcony looking out over his kingdom and saying, look at what I have done. And God helps him realize, nope, sorry, you're not as powerful as you think you are. And realizes that he needs to acknowledge God in his life. And as he does that, his kingdom is restored. On the other hand, Belshazzar does not do that. And he's basically assassinated. And in a moment, the kingdom of Babylon is gone. And we're introduced to a new empire, which becomes the Persian Empire. And we'll read about that in the rest of Daniel. Pride has a way of infecting people's minds and their ways of thinking that puts themselves in the place of God. But what we've realized in both of these stories is that human power and human rule is relative. God's is absolute. That's basically what just happened. This empire that ruled the globe in a moment is gone. And you can read, if you like reading history, you can read about all the other empires that have come and that have gone. And all of them believing themselves to be rulers. And we don't have to go that far back in history to see how that happens. One of the things that Mussolini said when he took over Italy was that the calendar starts with his own life. Time itself is determined by him as the ruler of Italy. It doesn't take much for humans to allow pride to infect their thinking and lead to some disastrous results. And what we've seen in the book of Daniel, the results that have taken place, this empire that existed is now gone. One of the things that we hear in Daniel 4 and 5, we hear a story, a dream about a tree that gives life. Do you know of another tree in a garden that gives life? Have you heard that before, a tree of life? Maybe you remember that from Genesis, this tree that God puts there that gives life. And we hear about that same tree in Revelation that gives life to all people. And Jesus uses a story about a little mustard seed that gets planted in the ground, and his kingdom is like this mustard seed and this tree that grows and gives life. Way back in the garden, God elevated humanity to rule with him. We are royal image bearers. A kingdom of priests and kings and prophets. That's what he called the Jews. You and I as human beings bear this royal image, as stained and as marred as it can become because of sin. We bear it nonetheless. And God elevates humanity to rule over this earth. That's what Adam was doing. When God brings all the animals before Adam and he names them, Adam is showing his power over them. He is ruling. He's given authority to Adam, to Eve, to humanity, basically, to rule and subdue the earth. But what happens when those people, those humans who bear this royal image and serve as a kingdom of kings and queens on this earth, what happens when pride begins to infect their way of thinking? When Adam and Eve put themselves in the place of God and thought, we know better than God, and violated the one thing God had said they shouldn't do, to eat of the tree of the good and evil, the knowledge of good and evil. What happens when humans begin to put themselves in the place of God? In Genesis chapter 11, in the Tower of Babel. That is the story that is taking place. Humans becoming prideful and saying, we can do anything we put our minds to. And pride begins to infect their way of thinking, and God scatters them, judges them, scatters them all over the earth. What happens when human pride begins to infect entire kingdoms and civilizations? When human beings rebel against the God who is sovereign over all? Well, if you study any history, you know what happens. And rather than humans bearing the royal image of God, we begin to take on the form of a beast. And that's going to come into play when Daniel starts having his dreams in chapter 7 through 12. That these kingdoms and these rulers are more like beasts than the royal image bearers they've been called to be. That's what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He became like a beast because pride had so infected his thinking. What happens when human kingdoms rebel against God? They look more like beasts. How can we do to one another what we do sometimes? One of the worst mars on human history, one of the worst things that we've done to each other, we can see in the Holocaust. When an entire society of people systematically killed people simply because they were Jewish. That was the only reason. They were Jewish. And an entire society sought to exterminate that race simply because they were Jewish. Whenever you hear the word genocide, we hear not human beings bearing the royal image, but we become like beasts. How can we do to one another what we have done? And it doesn't have to be to that grand of scale. You can watch a YouTube video of not too long ago, a lady walking down the street and getting clubbed over the head with a 2x4. Why? Because that person wanted to do it. You can find those videos all over the internet right now. Because rather than bearing the royal image, we are putting ourselves in the place of God, whether it's human rulers or individuals, and saying we don't need to acknowledge God, we don't think he exists, we are our own rulers, we have become gods unto ourselves. And so when I walk down the street and I burn that building that that guy or that girl has spent their entire life savings to create, and that's their business, and now their family is destitute because they have no place to go to work. Doesn't matter. When I go and I rob that person, when I club somebody over the head just because they look the way that they look, we've put ourselves in the place of God. We've rebelled against the God who made us. And rather than God elevating us to rule with him and bear this royal image, we look more like beasts, treating each other like animals. Pride has a way of infecting our lives. And if an entire culture becomes prideful and rejects God's existence, bad things happen. We can see it happening today, and history is replete with stories of how humans will treat one another. Daniel is warning those leaders against getting to that place where you become so prideful that you've rebelled against God, and you look out over this great, vast earth, and you say, look at what I have done. Look at what we have done. We don't need a God. We are gods unto ourselves. Human history is filled with tragic stories of what takes place when that happens. And not only does it affect human history, pride affects each one of us. The big problem that Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar both had was that they refused to acknowledge God in their lives. Now, if you can remember, if you were here at Grace Church last summer, all the way back to last summer, I know that's a long time ago, I preached a sermon series out of the book of Hosea. Hosea was a prophet, and that's basically what he had to say to everybody that in his day. You have refused to acknowledge God, and because of that, bad things are going to happen. When humanity refuses to acknowledge God, and pride gets in the way and puts ourselves in place of God, we're beginning to see, when we turn on the television, what can happen in our world, what can happen in our own communities, in the cities that we live in, that we travel to, that we visit, that our families live in. Our greatest defense against human pride is acknowledging God in our lives. So when Daniel says that God's rule and his reign will be victorious, as followers of Jesus, it ought to at least be victorious in our own lives. And then we ought to be able to then treat other people, other human beings who bear that royal image, though it might be stained, though it might be marred, though it might have lots of scars on it, who still bear that royal image, we ought to be able to treat them in a way that shows them respect and dignity as humans. And what we're finding is when pride begins to infect our way of thinking, we stop giving people that kind of dignity. And so we'll start writing messages on Facebook and social media and start tearing them down. Rather than trying to understand one another, hatred begins to build in us, and I get angry, and there's lots of animosity, and there's lots of vitriol, and you name the adjective to describe it, and you can see it everywhere in our world. And now because you like that politician, and I like that politician, we used to be friends, and now we hate each other. Our families used to vacation together, now we can't stand the sight of each other. This is what pride does to people. Maybe you don't see yourself as being prideful that you know better than him or her, but that's what it's beginning to lead to. And once it infects all of society, rather than seeing that person as another human being worthy of life, we don't care about hurting them, clubbing them over the head with a 2x4 simply because we can. The greatest defense against pride is to acknowledge God, and here's how I've defined that. Recognizing the Lord's authority in the context of my everyday life and how I make decisions in my and my family's future. Now, God calls us to do that in spite of the present circumstances. When it seems like evil is winning the day, because of our belief in the God that we love and serve, we say, at least in this kingdom, and Ted and Jess's kingdom that we have, of our own little family, we're going to acknowledge God in our lives. Your presence here this morning is a small way of you doing that. You got up this morning and either got in your car and drove here or turned on the television and you're watching it live. In a small way, you said, I am choosing to acknowledge God in my life because I believe God has something to say to me and I think he is worthy of my praise. Because of, you named the list. I prayed about some of it today. A great week with our teens and safety throughout the week and our service. We should acknowledge God that he saved Andy's life, the way that things worked out. His artery was blocked 80%. A little bit longer, and he might have had a massive heart attack. There's lots of reasons why we can acknowledge God, and your presence here this morning does that. And when you walk out of here, you have a choice of doing that as well. Am I going to at least acknowledge God in my life? And how I make decisions about my future. Because if I say yes to that, it ought to determine how I treat other people. Imagine if the people who lead us, who are given power and authority by God, it's not theirs, it's God's, and he's given it to them. Imagine if they did this and acknowledged that there was a greater power out there than them, even though by the stroke of a pen, they can change all of our lives. And if you don't think that power goes through your head, you need to read Daniel 4 and 5 again. All they got to do is sign something, and now your and my life is completely different. Imagine if they recognize God's authority in their life. That's why we as a church pray about it. That's why we say we want leaders who do that. Because the alternative is pretty bad. But what we at the church, in the church, are challenged to do is at least in our lives, we recognize and acknowledge God. Every day I wake up, thank you, God, for giving me life. Every day I sit down to have a meal with my family, thank you, God, for providing it for me. There are lots of small things you can do to acknowledge God in your life and say, this kingdom, though it's small like this mustard seed and really doesn't seem to have a whole lot of power in this world, it's going to grow. And this kingdom that Jesus set up is the one that's going to bring life. And ultimately, it'll bring life to all of the world. But that starts with me and with you, acknowledging God in our lives and how we make decisions, how we raise our families, how we treat other people that think differently than us, that vote differently than us, what we see and how we envision the future. What do we believe about God? Remember, Daniel's reminding all the people reading this, has God forgotten about us? Is God really powerful enough in the midst of what we're experiencing, even when it seems like evil is winning the day? Is God still there? Daniel is reminding us, yes, he is. Just have courage to keep following. Be confident in that God will one day reign supreme and his goodness will flood the entire earth. And so you can live with hope, not with despair, not angry and hateful all the time, not bitter. Yeah, those days come. There are hard days out there. But Daniel says you can live with hope because God's rule and reign will be victorious. And as followers of Jesus, the greatest defense we have against pride getting into our own life, well, we can point the finger about all those leaders who let pride into their lives. Before we begin pointing that finger, maybe we ought to make sure, have I acknowledged God in my life, with my family, with all that I have, with my possessions, with my money, with my time? This ought to start with the church and with us and with our families. And think of the difference it would make if we started living like God's rule and reign was supreme in our own lives. And as a result of that, we experience God's goodness in new and fresh ways. Let's pray. God, we are thankful for your goodness to us. God, this morning I just want to acknowledge that we as a church family are thankful how you provide for us. God, you have brought us through a lot since March. There's been a lot of challenges that we've had to overcome, a lot of difficult days, speaking personally as the pastor, a lot of uncertainty and questions about if we're still going to be able to provide for the ministry and the mission. But God, you have provided for us. And all that we see, Lord God, is not because of our own doing, but it's because of you. God, I pray that each one of us in this room today would acknowledge you in our lives. Thank you for bringing each one out this morning to hear from you, to praise you together. And I pray as we walk out these doors, God, that your rule and reign in our lives would continue, and that we would live as a part of your kingdom amidst this vast empire that we find ourselves in. God, I pray that you would guard us against pride, that we think ourselves better than others, that we think ourselves more righteous than others, Lord. But Lord, that we would live as royal image bearers of yours, and that we would treat others with dignity and respect and honor. Because though as marred as they can be at times, they too bear this image. God, in the midst of these challenging times we find ourselves in, I'm thankful that we can find hope in who you are. God, I pray for the kind of faith that gives us victory over these challenges. Lord, I pray that we would experience your goodness in new and fresh ways. And I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.